Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Hi, I'm Anne-Marie Cox, and welcome to The Churn, an Expanse podcast that is a little different. I sort of assume a lot of you are joining us after having listened to every other episode of The Churn, and so you know what's up and how this podcast is a little bit different than other science fiction TV show recapping podcasts. The main way it's different is this. I come from a politics background. I've worked at Mother Jones, The Washington Post, Time Magazine. I currently have a podcast at the Crooked Media Network called With Friends Like These. My co-host, Dan Dresner, is a professor of international politics at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He specializes in international relations, as I said. He's a politics nerd. I'm a politics nerd. That's what we look for in The Expanse. I mean, we like all the other stuff, too. The acting, the explosions, the writing, the metaphors, the actors themselves. Both of us have faves that you will hear about, you've already heard about. But we're also really interested in what The Expanse has to say about class and war and electoral politics and capitalism and terrorism and chain of command. And The Expanse takes those things rather seriously. We take them seriously, too. Not to say that the podcast is serious. If you are still listening, I assume you are also interested in this approach. And once again, nothing is missing. We will talk about what Avasarala wears. We'll talk about jokes. We'll talk about the blue goo. We will talk about it all. Coming right up, a discussion of The Expanse, Season 4, Episode 1, New Terra.
I want to start with what I think is the theme of this episode of The Expanse, which is the impossibility of starting anew. That there is always something to build on, that there is always, you're never going to have a blank slate.
There is no clean slate.
Yes. There is no clean slate. And the quote that I have chosen to represent this entire concept is from, of course, our favorite character, Amos. Well, I think currently favorite character, Amos.
Yes.
There's a lot of past in my past.
That is not my favorite line of his, by the way, in this episode, but that does aptly characterize what is going on in this episode.
Yes, we have sort of layers of history coming up. We have the impossibility of these fresh starts. Bobby on Mars can't start fresh, really. She has a past that she has to answer for. She has these memories. She has a history. Earth, Mars, and the Belt can't start all over again. They all have these existing connections and existing resentments. And of course, Illis. And on Illis, there's something on Illis. There's no blank state. I mean, I'm sure there's some other examples of this idea that I'm not coming up with.
Well, I think the first signal of this is the fact that you know, it starts with one of the first scenes is Holden visiting his mother.
That's right.
The fact that Naomi can't go down to the surface because it would be too much of an adjustment for her as a Belter. That acknowledgement by Holden, but the fact that his parents collectively can't quite accept that. And then they do that very awkward conversation over the computer screen.
They basically do
FaceTime. And then Holden grabs the screen and says, "That was excruciating." And Naomi says, yes, it was.
Yeah, it's nice to know that, like, interacting with relatives over FaceTime stays excruciating for the next two centuries. I guess exactly. There's no technology that can improve that. I will say that, of course, everyone who's listening to this will have already heard my interview with Dominique Tipper about that scene, where she talks about that awkwardness that happens when you're interacting with someone who doesn't quite understand your subculture or your culture period, that they're trying to adapt it, or they're trying to maybe co-opt it a little bit and not getting it quite right.
Right. And to be fair, they're even making an effort at it. I mean, like one of his fathers like tries to speak Belter, I believe, you know.
That's the thing that we both zeroed in on, because I think her expression there is so exquisite. Like, yeah. It's just, she knows they mean well, but also it's like mildly offensive.
Yes.
So impossibility of new starts. And of course, Vassarala also has like an entire history that she has to answer for. And that's all both personal, and we're talking a little bit of geopolitics here, but perhaps speaking of impossible fresh starts, we can talk about Mars and Paul Krugman.
We can. So one, I think in some ways, the most interesting sort of geopolitical turn or political economy turn that the show takes in season four, which I confess I did not anticipate in our conversations about the previous seasons, is that I think to put it generously, Mars is in a funk. For the first three seasons, Mars knew what it wanted. It wanted to terraform its planet. It was a very martial society. There was a very common sort of solidarity among the people that had caused them to, you know, build an incredibly modern fleet and to really be an equal to Earth in the system. And in some ways, it's not so the combination of the ring posing the possibility of new planets out there, plus a peace treaty or what seems like a durable peace with Earth, has really thrown Mars for a spin, because in that they're decommissioning ships and the enthusiasm for terraforming doesn't seem to be quite the way it was. And, you know, Bobby was already in trouble based on what had happened in season three, but it's clear that now she is not the only displaced person in Mars, that Mars for the first time is dealing with something along the lines of unemployment, which brings us to Paul Krugman. So because in some ways, while I'm interested in the geopolitics of the show, Paul Krugman is clearly interested in the macroeconomics. The implication in this first episode is that Bobby is, you know, adjusting to civilian life in a lower station, presumably, than she had when she was in the Martian Marines. And she's not the only one. She talked with another, you know, former Marine, you know, who's got this issue. And one of the things that Krugman suggests is that Mars's odd problem is they're suffering now from secular stagnation, which is to say that, you know, why are they having such mass unemployment? And it is actually a little odd, because my first reaction to this was questioning, in the sense of, you know, if you think about peace dividends historically, like the United States benefited from the end of the Cold War. It actually allowed us to start, you know, running something along the lines of a more balanced fiscal policy. And eventually all that capital that had been put aside in the defense industry got reallocated. You actually saw the beginnings of what was a productivity boom in the 1990s. But I think Krugman might actually be right that in order to deal with, if you're Mars, what you need to do is actually a large infrastructure project. The way to boost unemployment.
Infrastructure week on Mars.
Yes, you need infrastructure week on Mars. You need to boost employment. And again, this is the paradox, though, because the infrastructure that Mars has been spending on has been terraformed. And this isn't said explicitly in episode one, and full disclosure, I haven't watched the full season yet. I'm only about halfway through, but I don't think I've seen anything that suggests they've abandoned terraforming. It's just doesn't seem quite as important as it did before, because we know through the ring that there are all these planets that have blue skies.
That's right. And it's also a philosophical problem, right? If we go back to the metaphors of the frontier, it's as though I'm trying to think of I don't know if there's a quite perfect historical analog, but it's as though you worked really hard to settle this frontier and you thought you were going to be able to, you know, reap the benefits of that at some point in the future. And then it turns out that there's a much better place to colonize. And like all of the costs that you've sunk into your homestead, I was thinking it's as though American settlers only got as far as the Mojave and started to build there. and it turns out like California is like just a little further away. Like this land is like milk and honey, and you built all this stuff in the desert already. Like, what are you going to do with all this stuff in the desert? It turns out it's not quite even like the dream that it was.
Yeah, no, that's pretty good. I mean, the analogy I was going to use, which isn't exactly the same, but I think it works, is imagine that you've developed, you've spent your entire life trying to figure out how to get from Europe to India around the Cape of Good Hope.
Oh, you know?
So, you know, you've like, you know every nook and cranny of the continent. And then suddenly the Suez Canal is developed.
Yep.
And it therefore becomes much easier to do it. So that's the other way I would think about it.
Yeah. And so there's this sort of both economic and kind of societal.
But it's more than
slump.
Economic. Exactly. Yes. So it's not, this is where I think, you know, Krugman's analysis is a little two-dimensional. He's right about secular stagnation. It's a thing. And I could actually imagine that this is a real problem with Mars, because I bet Martians save like the, and that's also an issue when it comes to secular stagnation. They're probably incredibly thrifty, and that's why you need the government to spend money as opposed to things like tax cuts. They won't work. But it's not just the economics. It's also, as you say, that, you know, and one of the things I liked about episode one in particular is we haven't spent a ton of time on Mars in the show so far. And I think one of my favorite parts about this episode in particular was literally just like the little like background, like announcements as Bobby is walking through, you know, walking through various buildings and so on and so forth in Mars, where it's all about like file your weekly report and, you know, we're all pulling towards the same thing. In other words, it's all the sort of Marxist propaganda that really meant something prior to the ring and prior to the peace with Earth, but now doesn't quite ring in the same way.
Yeah, I agree. I enjoyed that too. And it reminded me a little bit. And I also think they can't quite do as much attention to detail in the TV show as the books can in terms of describing the feel of Mars. Yeah. But I think you get a little bit of this from, because in the books, it's definitely sort of this sense of it used to be everything was like brand new and shiny. Mm-hmm. And even before, I would say, the ring gates opened, there was like it to keep up brand new and shiny in an environment like Mars takes a ton of work. Right.
Right. And by the way, this reflects, you know, again, to connect it to sort of current global political economy, this is consistent with countries that have engaged in very rapid catch up. You know, very often look technologically more sophisticated because they can build tons of neon and so on and so forth. And it looks very shiny. You wait 10 years and suddenly a lot of that stuff starts to look more dingy. It's easier to catch up than it is to maintain that sort of modern facade.
And I also think it has to do with the fact that there's been some loss of obviously energy to keep that up. Right. Mm-hmm. So whereas they might have had at some point, like, or I should say, like before the ring gates open, everyone's like, yes, we're going to shine every day. We're going to polish every day. We're going to keep all the new stuff looking new. And now, like, you can sort of get this feel from the way that Bobby's work is depicted, where it's a little bit, everyone's a little more casual maybe than they used to be, a little more, you know, a little more blasé about keeping things up. Like, it
and
doesn't
without giving anything away,
anymore.
I think that theme is developed further.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I again, don't want to give up too much. But man, Bobby's arc is so frustrating.
No, but so again, that is consistent with some of the international relations on this. There's an older international relations scholar, Ibn Khaldun, who talks about the sort of life cycle of empires and how basically that it's four generations. The first generation has to deal with a very, very hard scrabble existence. So they're extremely energetic. The second generation, you know, has that same feeling, but also has more wealth. And so they're able to put it to better use. But by the third and fourth generations, it's starting to wear down. And therefore, it's definitely a thing.
I think that I want to move from Mars to the belt, because I think that's another quasi martial culture, right? Yeah. Like, well, they've always had an enemy. Well, they've always been fighters. And I don't mean that maybe like, I don't mean that actually in a martial sense. I mean that in survivors, right? Yeah. They have been in the struggle for a long time.
I would say the difference, or one of the differences, is that in the belt, the sense of grievance is extremely strong, you know, in the sense of they feel put upon by both the, by the inners, and justifiably so in a lot of ways. So yeah, and this clearly affects what's happening now.
I feel like Earth in some ways the Earth reaction to the belt is very intelligible to us Earthers, right? Like, like, I think it's almost like the same as it would be if it happened today, which is like, there's one half that's like, this is dangerous, let's not do it. And one half that's like, we need this, we need to move forward. Like, right. We need to do a land grab. But yes. It seems like very terrestrial point of view, right? Where there's a Martian point of view that's different that we just finished discussing. And then there's a Belter point of view that I think is different as well. Like, it's a much more, although there is some urgency on the Earth side, I feel like with the Belters, I mean, this is so life or death.
It's their attitudes towards risk. I think the Earthers are, at least, you know, the government is more, it's a more affluent society, even with 50% unemployment. And so as a result, they're more risk averse. They don't want, you know, what Avarasala is clearly worried about is the risk of what happened to whatever civilization developed the ring, you know, happening to Earth. Whereas with the belt, there's a much greater tolerance for risk because their status quo is so much more unacceptable.
And because they've had like their homes repeatedly taken away.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, yeah, the belters that actually get through the ring are on Ganymede, which has been destroyed for what, a season and a half at this point?
Well, I have some quotes to kind of keep us grounded in this episode. And one of them is, Illus is our home now and we will not be driven out again, which I thought was a really interesting statement on one level, because yes, the Belters have always had homes, true, but they've always been kind of improvisational, right? And they've been a somewhat itinerant culture, right? I think that's my understanding, is that they've been willing to move from place to place. That's what, right. Part of what they do.
They're and in so, space. Yeah.
Right. So I think the idea that they're already like, this is our home, is an interesting, it's a very terrestrial point of view.
Yeah. And, no, and I think that's also set up in the conversation. One of the things I liked that this show did, that this episode did in particular, was by having the Rocinante going to Illus, it allowed them to like connect with the other characters. So, you know, Alex has the conversation with Bobby, but then the conversation between Drummer and Naomi. On this point particularly was interesting, where Kamina sort of thinks that the opening of the ring will actually be an end to the Belters, or mm-hmm. or will, you know, is a real threat to the Belters. As she puts it, I think, as she says, you know, within two generations, these folks are not going to think of themselves as they'll have no memory of living in space. They won't even think about it. And indeed, as you point out, the attitude of Illus is ours now. It doesn't even take that long.
Yeah. When she, I wrote down that conversation too, because it is so interesting. Like her, she says, we are creatures of space, which yeah. again, it's, I sort of, not tethered, literally, right? Not tethered right. to any one thing.
And then Naomi says, like, we have a right to choose.
Yeah, she does. And then Drummer's response is that your children won't have the right to choose. That if you do this, then your children are going to be inners. And I just think that's so interesting. I mean, I think that's going to be an ongoing discussion.
It is there is a way in which that exchange is one of the fundamental political debates about identity, which is, you know, are you an individual who has some freedom of choice, or are you part of a community with, as you say, not a clean slate and you've inherited a particular heritage? And depending upon the interpretation, what does that mean for your politics?
I would think that we can move from there to the Rossi, because that's a crew of people who have, you know, made a decision about their identities and their community.
That sounds good. There was one last thing I wanted to say about the OPA, which is, again, in terms of international relations metaphors, the thing that struck me watching, you know, both Drummer and Ashford in this episode was they've become the Palestinian Authority.
Interesting.
Yeah. No, that's exactly what the way to think about it, which is that, you know, so they're dealing with, they have their population, but what they are doing is enforcing an embargo essentially imposed upon them by the inners. And they've agreed to do this because they are getting something from this. They've got Medina Station in the ring. They're clearly, you know, developing a state. That's what they want to do. But the resentments between, you know, the OPA government essentially and the Belters themselves, who feel like they've now sort of sold themselves out. I'm going to be very interested in this dynamic as it goes.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting metaphor, and one that points up the instability, not just of the factions and the Belters, but of course, between the Belters and the other, you know, participants in the treaty, because they have been given no reason to trust Earth and Mars, right? Like, they have been shit on for so long. Like, the idea that they can just, that the Enders can now just say, oh, but now we're all on the same team. And now, like, yes, if you do what we want you to do, we'll give you this reward. We'll give you this thing that you want.
And to be fair to the Belters and to Drummer and Ashford, this is a tough choice. It's not obvious. You know, if you really believe in an OPA state, there's a logic to accepting this because it gives you resources. You are treated as an equal, relatively speaking, even
ish,
if not in,
yeah.
Yes, but like nominally, like there is some recognition of equality that there had never been before. You know, OPA had been treated as a terrorist organization in the first two seasons. Now suddenly they are at least nominally treated as a co-equal of the Enders. You can see why that is appealing to people like Drummer. And at the same time, however, there is a belief within the Belters, and you see this throughout this first episode, that people have sold out.
Yeah. Although it's a bit, again, it goes back to that other question, though. You've sold out, and yet the people of Illis have made a choice to be more like Inners, too. I think what happens here is that there's just a fundamental instability to the inner. I think there's a fundamental instability to the Belter identity that just hasn't been drawn into question until now. In part because they've been so marginalized, because they were excluded. They had to have a very cohesive identity because they depended on each other.
And the idea of even being a terrestrial never occurred to them. Yes.
Right. And it is they have more choices now, they have more freedom now, which means that it's harder to hold on to that group identity. I think that there's probably, I think that's just a true thing for humans too, right? Although this is where it'll be interesting if it goes back into labor issues, because that's the other way that you could have consciousness, right? Like, you could have a class consciousness rather than like a where you live consciousness.
Although, again, one of the interesting things is, like, so, you know, we had, there's this conversation about how the folks on Illis have struck lithium. And so in some ways they're treated and the metaphor is explicit throughout this episode that these are people who are treated like gold prospectors.
They've
journeyed west. And so I don't think look this way. You're correct that this is a conflict in terms of their identity, because as Belters, they've seen themselves as the exploited. The people on Illis, the Belters who have sat there, now think of themselves no longer as Belters. They are residents of Illis that are owners, much in the same way that, you know, downtrodden Europeans came to the United States.
Right. They're the rentier class. Like, I kept on wanting to like criticize the expedition, the Royal Expedition, which is the RCE, which is so explicitly based on the Dutch East India Company. I kept on wanting to think of them as the bad guys and the capitalist pigs. But it's also true that the Belters there,
they're all capitalist pigs,
very much engaged in capitalism,
or entrepreneurs, depending upon you.
Entrepreneurs, if you want to be more generous about it.
Yes. So actually, if it makes you feel any better, one of my IR colleagues, Martha Finnemore, she's a very prominent IR scholar, also obsessed with the Expanse, and she is obsessed with Mercury in particular.
Might have to have her on.
Yes. Oh, I'd be happy to set that up. It's not like the Belters who are on Illis are necessarily any different. They got there first, but they both in some ways have the same goal, which is to extract the resources.
Yes. Extractive capitalism. Yeah. So speaking of extractive capitalism, actually, I can still bring this back to the Rossi, because there is a funny throwaway claim. Actually, maybe this is not a spoiler, even if it is in episode two, but there's a throwaway line where someone says something like, oh no, it's in episode one. So there's
it's
a funny throwaway.
Yeah.
They say, that was nice of Asarala to recognize our salvage claim.
Which I have to admit, it does put a bow on that, because I've always wondered, like, how have they been able to get through three seasons without the Martians just trying to seize the damn ship?
Really,
it was theirs. You know.
It's really their salvage claim has been recognized.
Yes.
So just in case everybody was wondering, the salvage claim has been recognized. And I guess that also explains, there's that scene of Amos like welding a plaque onto the Rossi to say who the captain is and whatnot. And I guess that means it's officially the Rocinante now.
Exactly.
And no longer the Tashi. Although I do like the fidelity to the history there. Again, going back to there's no new start, that they're all carrying Tashi bags and
right, and like the gear hasn't changed. Exactly. Yes.
Exactly. They have to do everything is reused. There is nothing new. I have another favorite quote I wanted to bring up, which is Holden, do not put your dick in it. It's fucked enough already.
And then Amos immediately says, that's good advice, you know.
He can always be counted on to like give like the right. I feel like Amos always has a very super pragmatic view on any kind of conflict. That is what you can count on him to do a good analysis of. And of course, we don't probably need to say who said that because there's only one person with a mouth foul enough to put that sentence together. And that's Christian. And I do. So there's a part of me that feels a little like, oh, this is a convenience of plot to send the Rossi out there. But at the same time, it is also true. Holden's the only person that really knows the protomolecule, like intimately.
Right. And it's clear that Christian understands that. And it values Holden, not just because of his past, but because he's got the contact with Miller, as it were, or Miller / protomolecule.
Proto Miller is what we call it.
Oh, that's right. Proto Miller. Yes. With Proto Miller. Yeah. And I will give Christian credit. Like, she recognizes why that's valuable and why it's worth sending them and them alone out.
Although at the same time, Holden's always putting his dick into stuff. Not literally. they're very monogamous with Naomi,
but he's putting the metaphorical metaphorically he is just a slut. There's no other way to
put it. That's right.
There is no issue that he will not stick his dick in. It's just
that is right. And it's no spoiler at all to say that of course the situation on Illis is going to make him do something. Like he can't just be an impartial, you know, judge. He always has a sense of who's right and who's wrong.
The other thing I was going to say is that I do like towards the end of the episode, one of the things, and I don't think this is a spoiler, is that when they finally get to Illis, it makes it clear that we've seen for the first three seasons, this show has been painted in one way, and we are about to get a new flavor of it because it is so set up like a Western on Illis.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a different...
Well, they changed the aspect ratio. Did you notice that?
Yeah. No, I did not notice that.
It's letterboxed. When the scenes on Illis are filmed in letterboxed, which is a much more epic, you know, kind of scene, right? Like it gives everything a much wider sense of space. And so it's definitely a Western. It's definitely like Sergio Leone kind of like, I use the word expanse.
Yes.
And
now we know the reason for the title. Yeah.
Right. And it's also the landscape is obviously like it's a blue desert, basically.
Right.
Right. It's a blue and gray desert.
No, and it's also, I think I've seen something this where like essentially this season is the first where they've shot a lot of it outdoors, mostly, I assume, in Illis. And so, there's a different feel to those scenes because it, as you say, it's both terrestrial, but it's not terrestrial that we've seen before.
Yeah, they want to make very clear like this is literally alien, right? Like this this is something where no human feet have been trotting before, where no human foot has trod before would be the more elegant way to put that. And I also think, so I had to watch each episode more than once in order to do this podcast. So I was watching episode one for the third time the other night. And I confess, part of me was like, what can I fast forward over? And I got to the scene where they disembark the Rossi to get to the settlement. And first thing I'll say is there wasn't a lot to fast forward over. The Expanse is very economical with its dialogue scenes, et cetera. Like they generally do not do a lot of stuff that doesn't need to be done. There's very little like frou-frou kind of, everything's important. So kudos to them.
One exception to this, as I don't think it was necessary, but I laughed my ass off, was when Amos asked what Avasarala was.
No, that's necessary. Okay, first of all, humor is important. I have not seen the whole season either, but I know for a fact, because they cannot not do it. I shouldn't say no for a fact. They could not explore. They could not not. Okay, Maester River. It's important in part because of humor and in part because Amos's backstory has to come into play at some point. He has a very interesting history with older women. Let's just put it that way. Like,
oh, again, good. Okay. Well, I think I believe you. We talked about this. There's a James Corey tweeted this out. The titular author of The Expanse suggested that Amos has an interesting backstory.
Yes. And I think his, and also I think it's just an acknowledgement, sort of an official tip of the hat by the show to the banter that they have. And so they are also the two most pragmatic tacticians on the show in terms of
and had a lovely, right. And they had a lovely shared, like they got along very well, I would say, when Avasarala was on the show.
Yeah, I think so too. They speak the same language, and I don't mean just vulgarity. Like, I feel like they really understand each other really well. Part of that has to do, I think, we've both experienced a lot of loss. And I think that both of them have a hard shell around a candy center, let's say. Well, Amos is really deep down in there, though. But the other thing I would say about Amos, though, if we're just going to talk, more intimate things than geopolitical things, is that scene with Clarissa where, you know, she asked him like, oh, you set it up so that I could possibly kill myself if I wanted to. And he's like, you're welcome.
Yes. Only in The Expanse would that be seen as a gesture of mercy.
Right. Right. There's no wasted scenes, because there is a couple of beats after she hangs up where Amos just looks like he's thinking. And that, I believe, is a new part of Amos emerging, that he would even sort of be thoughtful about that exchange. I think the Amos that we met in season one could have that exchange still. I think his idea of mercy being, you know, I'm going to give you a way to commit suicide probably existed back then. But his ability to kind of take in an emotional input from someone else and then think about it a little bit and think about what that relationship is, I think is new for him.
I agree. And it's a powerful data point. When we talked about Amos in the past, I think in a previous podcast, I suggested that there was a sociopathic aspect to him that, and you push back on that hard. And I think you're winning the argument here. Absolutely.
Yeah. Just that beat of like,
yes,
thinking.
It's which makes me happy, because again,
thought. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. No, it's been a pleasure to watch Wes Chatham play this role.
He is so good.
Impressive. Yes. It's impressive.
And those who haven't heard my interview with him, it was fascinating for me. I'm not recommending it just because like, woohoo, I did a great interview. It was, he's such an interesting actor. His approach to that character is so interesting, and how it's informed by his research into trauma and whatnot. Just a really, really, a lot of deep work going on there, as they say sometimes in therapy. So that little scene with Amos and Clarissa, not wasted. And then the other thing that I was thinking about as I rewatched the episode for the third time is there's the scene when they disembark the Rossi to actually walk on the planet of Illus. There is a drone shot, probably an eagle eye perspective shot as they travel the landscape. And a part of me was like, okay, I can fast forward over this. And then I thought, wait a minute, why is this here? Like, this is an unlike The Expanse a little bit, that usually doesn't indulge in scenery for scenery's sake, if you know what I mean. Like,
look at this
battles.
Gorgeous vista that we have paid tremendous sums of money to set up a camera.
I don't believe that they would do that. And so I was
right.
Thinking,
that's my point. Yes.
Right,
others have done that.
Right. Why would this be here? And I tried to just really look at what they were doing. And I think there's a few things going on. One is communicating the alienness, the foreignness of this planet, how even the color palette is kind of different than Earth. There's not a lot of landscapes that look a lot like that on Earth, especially I think for like North Americans, you know. And then also, I don't know if you got this, but there's, for me, a kind of a sense almost that landscape is, if not alive, then it has its own, again, maybe this is, it has its own history. It has its own kind of way that it's going to be. And their tracking through it is I don't want to say violation, but they don't belong there.
the way, the other thing I would say, the other utility of that shot is the sense of scale, in the sense of it's the contrast between the vast landscape and essentially these four dots that you see moving in the drone shot. They're entering an expanse over which they have not nearly as much control as we might have thought, you know, when they were on the Rossi.
Or even leaving the Rossi is kind of like a, right. you know, having to be away from their home in this very, like, a place that they, it's now theirs, their salvage claim got recognized.
And again, good for them, you know.
It's great that that paperwork finally went through. I do think Naomi's journey is just beginning, as to just really lean on cliches. I think her decision to try and do the gravity therapy, I mean, I'm sure she considered it. It's not a thoughtless thing that she's done at all. At the same time, I think it's maybe she's never made a challenge that she hasn't been able to rise to, except for her when she lost her child, when she lost her son. I think that's what she considers maybe her biggest loss and one of the few, you know, that she blames herself for, that she was not able to in her mind, rise to the occasion that she should have been able, things she should have been able to do, which she wasn't able to do. I think this going through the gravity therapy is maybe something that she does not quite have an appreciation for. Oh God, I was about to say the gravity of the situation. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, Naomi.
A really weighty decision on her part. That's true. Yeah.
But I think it's the case. I think it's not like she went through it rashly. I mean, that's not it. She's of course like a super smart person, but the full implications of it are something that she's still going to uncover. That's still,
yeah, this is not going. Unfold. And it's, there's a nice bit of foreshadowing, I suspect, without giving anything away, where literally the first like step she takes on Illis, mm-hmm. she stumbles and falls.
And that scene is also, there's a reason why that's there, sort of thing. And I think part of it is the foreshadowing, and part of it is that Holden doesn't help her. And right. Actually Amos tries to, and Holden keeps him back. And I think that was a kind of nice moment. Like, we're going to let her figure mm-hmm. this out on her own. But I also, to me, that sort of says that Naomi still has stuff to figure out on her own. You know, yeah. like she's not quite the problem solver that she thinks she is. She's because she is so smart. She is, I think we could probably say, the smartest of the characters in terms of just her intellectual curiosity. In the books, by the way, it's made much more clear that she's kind of a genius.
Right. No. And I think the show does make it clear she's nothing else, the best educated.
Yeah. Well, not
without saying she's smarter, but she's best. Yeah.
But just her ability to like work with code and whatnot, and her ability to like see patterns. And then Amos, of course, is also has a sort of Western. He's not quite a sidekick, but he is the gunslinger. He is a gunslinger, I think we can say, when he rides into town.
And then there's Alex.
And I always feel like that's actually something that people, you can say a lot. And then there's Alex, although I think I've shared with you that he's one of my favorite characters. Or at least all of them are so great, but he is a character that I really identify with because I feel like he's the true introvert of them.
Well, he's also the only one of them that acknowledges fear.
That's right.
He has a great exchange with Bobby, in which he basically says, you know, and it's actually a lovely exchange where he confesses to Bobby that he admires and envies her because Bobby's unafraid, you know, when she goes into the hall at these high risk positions, whereas Alex is not. And indeed, when I was rewatching some of the show, I forgot that in the first season, when they're on the Doninger, it's Alex the one is freaking out, even though he's got mm-hmm. the most military service of a lot of them.
Yeah, he has two things I like about him. One is that he's the most emotional, even next to Holden, right? He is the most emotional. And then also he's the one who I think if he would be so happy if it was just them like floating through space, you know, like
if it was
just the crew of the Rossi and he got to fly the Rossi and he got all of his alone time with the ship, which he. Yes. is important to him, you know. Right. I think he loves being a pilot and flying solo in the Rossi, not really having a co-pilot, just being able to be the guy. And then he likes having his little tiny family that he can cook for.
Yeah.
And if they never met another single living soul,
that's paradise for Alex.
He would be really, really happy. I mean, and he also, I think, can perform socially, you know, if he has to. And he's like a good natured guy and everything. But
he's a Texan. Yeah.
That's right. He's a good natured guy, but he's always going to be happiest if it's his tribe. And I think that is sort of his, he's always kind of the one like, come on, like, let's consider our family here. And I will be interested to see how that dynamic also plays into the Illis situation. Because I think everyone else on the crew, even at this point, Amos has an impulse to try and do good, right? Overall, like to try and like to, they put, want to put their dicks in it. Damn it. Not to foreshadow too much about Amos. And you know, and Alex is going to be the one saying like, whoa, like, let's make sure we're okay. But you need that. You need that in a family, I think.
No, that's the whole thing. Without those contrasting impulses, it's not a believable. Yeah. No, it's great.
I have one last quote I want to share and get your thoughts on before we say goodbye. And it returns us to, I think, the theme of there never being a return to zero, never being able to have a completely blank slate. And it's a quote from Drummer, your girlfriend. When she has that conversation,
like a schoolgirl. Yes.
When she has a conversation with Naomi, and she says, yes. Naomi asks about her back, and she says, mm-hmm. "It only hurts when I move, which means the nerves are regrowing."
I actually remember that line, thinking, "Oh, yes, yes, she is my crush. There's no denying that."
But to me, like I'm going to just push the metaphor, which is growing hurts. The growth of this universe, the growth of this galaxy, the growing that the human race is going to have to do, it hurts. There's going to be pain that's associated with trying to adapt to the new environment that they're in, both the new environment in a political sense and obviously the new environment in Illis.
And it does share the connection between Drummer and Naomi, because Naomi, you know, there is that scene, which again is useful, of demonstrating that it's one thing to say in the abstract, oh, sure, all she has to do is take the gravity drugs and she'll be fine on the, you know, on the surface. And then you see what she's actually going through. And as you say, it's an adjustment.
Yeah. But that and just means that the nerves are there. That's the other thing I love about that. But if it didn't hurt, then we wouldn't be human.
It's one of my favorite lines in all of movies. It's A League of Their Own. Do you know what line I'm going to say?
It's probably not "There's no crying in baseball," but that's the only one I know.
Oh no! This one of my favorite lines. It's when Gina Davis's character is going to go home because she's getting married, and she says to Tom Hanks, "You know, I just didn't think it was going to be so hard." And he says, "Of course it's hard. It was easy. Everyone does it. It's the hard that makes it."
Well, we'll just end with a quote from an entirely different genre of movie, and. I am excited for the season to unfold. I'm excited for you to come back and talk to us more about the analogs, the very helpful analogs. And if there is, in fact, anything that we in this time period as humans can learn from what the humans of the expanse are going through, as the show creators, I think they quoted you once that humans learn nothing, but we can try.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Dan.
Thank you.
And that is it for the show. If you liked what we had to say about The Expanse, you might be interested in what we have to say about other things. You can find me at my podcast on Crooked Media Network. It is called With Friends Like These. Dan is the author of many books. He also is a columnist for The Washington Post. If you're a fan of The Expanse and genre fiction in general, you might enjoy his book, Theories of International Politics and Zombies, and he has a new book coming out, The Toddler in Chief, What Donald Trump Teaches Us About the Modern Presidency.